Thanks for joining us. I'm Catty Kay, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane is on a cruise with public radio listeners. Audrey Niffenegger is a self-described cemetery tourist. That's why she chose to set her latest novel near her favourite graveyard, London's historic Highgate Cemetery. Audrey is the author of the best-selling novel The Time Traveller's Wife. Her new book is titled Her Fearful Symmetry, and she joins me in the studio to talk about ghosts, twins, and why she's drawn to quirky, troubled characters. Audrey, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
We will be opening the phones later on in the programme. 1-800-433-8850 is the phone number, and our email address is drshow@wmu.org. Do send your questions and comments in for Audrey during the course of the hour. Audrey, I want you to explain the title to me. My daughter saw this on my kitchen sideboard yesterday and looked at the cover and said, Her Fearful Symmetry. Mum, what does that mean, Audrey?
Well, two out of the three words are borrowed from William Blake, his poem that starts off, Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night, and concludes with, and I probably can't do the two lines off the top of my head, but what fearful hand or what something hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry. And the image in the poem is one of this beautiful, luminous, dangerous tiger lurking. And the title refers to a number of different things in the novel. The first and most obvious is a character named Elsbeth Noblin, who spends most of the novel as a ghost. And the combination of attractiveness and dangerousness seemed to perfectly describe her. But also, the idea of symmetry runs throughout the novel, both in the characters themselves. For example, there's a pair of mirror twins who are literally symmetrical. One of them is completely internally reversed. This is a real thing, by the way. People keep asking me if I made it up. And anyway, so symmetry runs through the whole thing, and everything in the novel has some kind of opposite or pair to it. So
you mentioned that Elspeth is a ghost. Let's begin by getting you to read a little bit, because, of course, she dies right at the beginning of the novel.
She does. The first chapter is called The End. Elspeth died while Robert was standing in front of a vending machine watching tea shoot into a small plastic cup. Later, he would remember walking down the hospital corridor with the cup of horrible tea in his hand, alone under the fluorescent lights, retracing his steps to the room where Elsbeth lay, surrounded by machines. She had turned her head towards the door, and her eyes were open. At first, Robert thought she was conscious. In the seconds before she died, Elsbeth remembered a day last spring when she and Robert had walked along a muddy path by the Thames in Kew Gardens. There was a smell of rotted leaves. It had been raining. Robert said, "We should have had kids," and Elsbeth replied, "Don't be silly, sweet." She said it out loud in the hospital room, but Robert wasn't there to hear.
And I should point out that as you're reading this, I'm looking at the picture opposite, which is a lovely black and white picture of what I imagine is Highgate Cemetery.
It is.
And Highgate Cemetery, of course, is one of the, almost like a character in your book. What made you want to set it there?
I first came to Highgate Cemetery in 1996, and I was attracted to it because I'm a big fan of the Pre-Raphaelites, and the Rossetti family is buried there. But there's so much more to it than that. I mean, it was founded in 1839 as part of a wave of social reform. They were going to get all the overcrowded churchyards free of the burden of burying everyone in London. And so they founded seven cemeteries in a ring on the perimeter of the city. And Highgate was by far the most romantic and fashionable of them all, and so it now has some very famous occupants, including Karl Marx and his family, Charles Dickens' family, George Eliot, the novelist, and so forth.
And describe it for us.
It's on a hill, and these days when you wander through it, all the paths curve, and so you never know what's about to present itself to you. Nowadays, it's very overcrowded with trees and shrubs and wildlife and all sorts of things like that, and the graves tend to jut out haphazardly. Along the main paths, there's some rather astonishing monuments. And as part of the original cemetery, there was this thing called the Egyptian Avenue, which is literally modeled after a tomb in Luxor and is very dramatic. It looks like a stage set for Aida or something like that. And as you wander through the avenue, you come to the Circle of Lebanon, which on top of the circle is this astonishingly large tree. It's about 300 years old. But the circle itself is lined on both sides with very large family mausoleums. And depending on the weather, it either seems rather charming and lovely in there or rather spooky and gloomy.
Which I think could be said of your novel, actually.
Yeah, that too.
Sometimes it's charming and lovely, and the relationships between the couples and Robert's love for Elspeth, and we see her die there at the beginning, and then sometimes it's kind of dark and spooky and rather bleak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say that's a quite fair assessment of it.
Tell us about the twins. There are two sets of identical twins, so those sort of four principal characters in the novel. Tell us about them.
Yes, the younger set of twins are Julia and Valentina Poole, and they have been brought up in Lake Forest, Illinois, which is a very wealthy suburb of Chicago. They never knew their aunt, Elspeth, the one who dies at the beginning, and they are very surprised one day to get a letter in the mail telling them that they have inherited her estate, including this flat that borders the cemetery. Their mother, Edie, was Elspeth's twin, and there's some unexplained disagreement which has caused this older set of twins, Edie and Elspeth, to not speak to each other for 21 years.
And the twins don't know that there has been this disagreement, or what the disagreement was.
The twins have a dim understanding that they have an aunt and that their mother doesn't speak to her, but that's about all they know.
Describe the characters of the younger twins and whether you feel they're mirrored in the characters of the older twins, because they're quite peculiar, Julia and Valentina, and in particular the relationship between the two of them is quite peculiar.
Many things about this book are modelled on 19th century English novels. In particular, Wilkie Collins' The Woman in White and two by Henry James, The Turn of the Screw and Portrait of a Lady. And one of the things I was doing at the very beginning of the project is looking through a variety of books to see what overused old plot devices and character types I could steal. And so from Henry James, I got the notion of the young American girls who come over to the old country and run into trouble. And Wilkie Collins' Woman in White turns on the extraordinary resemblance between two young women who don't know that they're related. And everything in the plot moves based on mistaken identity and mistaken parentage and all these other things, which have come to seem rather creaky. And I thought, well, let's see if we can take all of this, just this big bag of cliches, and just try it out and see if we can make it seem compelling and quirky and new. And so that's what I've been trying to do. And in particular, the characters of Julia and Valentina are a reversion to a type of girl that hardly exists anymore. And so they are like 19th century girls who have wandered into a 21st century book. And so they would seem, I think, to a 21st century reader to be strangely isolated. And there are references to pop culture and to the internet and to that kind of thing, but these twins are very involved with each other, and they have created their own little world. Something that was interesting to me as I started working on this was that people would say, well, what are you working on? I'd say, oh, it's a ghost story. It's got these twins. And the person I was talking to would occasionally say, well, I'm a twin. And I would say, well, no, you're not. I've known you for years. You're just you. No, I'm a twin. And then they would tell me this story about growing up, and there was a certain point in the growing up where the twins would have to decide how much individuality they were going to have as grown-ups. And in the case of these three different people that this happened, I had this conversation with, it was always, well, you know, now my twin lives over here and we talk on the phone now and then, but we're not living a joint life. And so the struggle in the book for these two characters is, are they going to keep on living in lockstep, or are they going to start to diverge?
So they go to London. They take Elspeth's apartment overlooking Highgate Cemetery. What happens to them there?
They don't know anyone, and they have been expecting that Robert, Elspeth's lover, will be there to help them out, but he is mysteriously absent. And part of this is that they look so much like their mother and aunt that they're freaking him out. And he's sort of watching them but not getting in touch with them in a fairly stalkerish way. Meanwhile, their upstairs neighbor is a man named Martin, whose wife has left him at the beginning of the book. And he's just sort of stuck in his apartment. He has both obsessive-compulsive disorder and agoraphobia and can't leave. And so his situation mirrors Elspeth's, because she has become a ghost and is stuck in her flat. And so one of the twins stumbles upon Martin and starts to get somewhat involved in his life. The other twin eventually becomes connected to Robert. And so it is like the Henry James plot, where these girls start to get involved with their very complicated neighbors.
You're giving us a sense of it there. And even from the brief description you've given us, it's, you know, it's apparent that this is a book that moves in so many parts, that you have the relationship between the twins you have, and you only just touched on it there, the obsessive compulsive disorder, which also in its own way is almost like a character in the book, that it is an incredibly complex book.
Yeah, this book, it's written in third person and has 10 major characters. And so, unlike my first book, where we had this couple which we obsessively focused on, this is an ensemble piece.
Audrey Niffenegger is the author of The Time Traveler's Wife, of course. Her new book is Her Fearful Symmetry. We'll be opening the phones in just a moment, 1-800-433-8850. Do stay listening. Welcome back. I'm Katty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. I'm joined in the studio by Audrey Niffenegger. She is the author of The Time Traveller's Wife, but also her new novel, which she's talking about with us today, is Her Fearful Symmetry. The phone number here is 1-800-433-8850. If you'd like to talk to Audrey, please do call us. And the email address is drshow@wamu.org. You can also send us a tweet as well. Audrey, we were speaking about the fact that there are 10 main characters, which is a lot for a novel. All of them have very strong presences in the novel. We spoke a little bit about the women. Let's speak about the men, because Martin and Robert, who are living in London, and then there's Jack, who is the father of the twins living in the US.
One of the things that I noticed about these earlier 19th century models that I was using was that quite frequently the women are driving the action. And without even meaning to make that happen, it is true of this book as well. And so the men spend a lot of time trying to figure out what the women are up to and reacting to it, and sometimes trying to extract themselves from it, or at least make sense of what their lives have become because of it. The first thing that happens to Robert in the novel is that his lover dies. The first thing that happens to Martin is that his wife leaves him pretty much for his own good, because she can't live anymore in this OCD complicated life. Jack, who's married to Edie back in the States and is the father of the twins, Jack has all these things that he's confused about, and he's just basically trying to hang on and figure things out. So there's a thing that the three men have in common, which is a kind of dogged persistence in their love for the women in their lives.
Let's talk a bit about Robert and Elspeth's relationship, because you read that chunk at the beginning there when Elspeth dies, and shortly after she dies, of course, Robert comes back into the room and sees that he's died, and he's clearly heartbroken.
Oh, completely heartbroken. And there's a thing that happens to people sometimes, which is that they cannot let go, and instead of the grief having stages, they just get stuck at some stage and they can't get on with their lives. And usually everybody around them is going, come on, you know, you've been a long time, come on, get on with it. And in Robert's case, partially because he's a volunteer tour guide at this cemetery where his lover is buried, and so he's walking by the grave all the time and spends a lot of time sitting at the foot of the grave, sort of having little conversations with her, and he's just not moving on in a way that's perceived by everyone around him as rather unhealthy.
And how does he realize that Elspeth hasn't actually left him?
Midway through the book, Elspeth, being a ghost and being stuck in the apartment and being actually a rather willful personality, determination is her main characteristic, she's slowly pulling herself together. She's slowly figuring out what the rules of being a ghost are and what she can and cannot do. And she eventually manages to communicate. And I won't do spoilers, but she does manage to get through in a way that both Julie and Valentina and Robert have to recognize is
that she's still there.
She's there, yeah.
And what's the relationship between Robert and Elspeth once he realizes that actually, does that make him feel better? Does it make him feel worse? Is it harder for him?
He initially is dumbfounded, as we all would be, I imagine. But he then lapses into this period of obsessively communicating back and forth with Elspeth and spends weeks virtually nothing else is going on in his life, and he's constantly up there in the apartment scribbling away with her. She's doing automatic writing. And, this does eventually give way to yet another stage. But it's a funny book, this one, because it's so hard not to do spoilers. And so I'm trying to stay within the safe parts of the book that won't ruin surprises for anyone. But
let's talk about one of the other men then in the book, Martin, because I found him fascinating. And the scene where right at the beginning of the book, where Marijke, his wife, realizes she's had enough, and she has to leave, and she wants to leave him a letter. But she can't leave it on any surface because she doesn't want that surface to be tainted for him in the future. That was so vivid for me, and her reasons for leaving are so clear when you see what she's going through.
Yeah, I mean,
and yet she loves him, it seems.
They love each other very much. They're both in their 50s, and she is a radio announcer for the BBC. And later she moves to Holland and is working for a Dutch station. He is a crossword puzzle setter and a translator. And so they both have these very lovely jobs, lovely lives, and they love each other. And yet this thing has just taken over. And I know from personal experience with somebody who has OCD that, you know, the most lovely, talented people, it just comes and rules their lives. And so in this case, she realizes that she can't help him. She can't live this way. And so the very first thing in the novel that you see happening to them is she leaves and goes back to Amsterdam, which is where she's from. And the letter that she leaves for him makes it clear to him that she won't be coming back, but that if he is willing to go to Amsterdam, then they can proceed with their marriage. So there's always this possibility hanging for them.
But in order for him to go to Amsterdam, he basically has to be cured of the OCD.
Yeah, in order for him to go to Amsterdam, he'll have to leave the apartment, he'll have to get in a car and a train and all these things that he can't do. So she's essentially kind of laid down the challenge. If you can do this, then we can continue our marriage.
There's a scene at the beginning of the book of Elspeth's funeral, and all of the characters that you've mentioned, apart from Jack and Edie, who've stayed in the States, they haven't come over. They're at the funeral. Robert's there, Martin and Marijke are there. What is the relationship between all the people in the apartment building? And how important was that to the setting of the novel?
Before Elsbeth dies, the relationship is essentially, there are two couples and they are friends. So Robert has the ground floor apartment, Elsbeth lives on the first floor, and Martin and Marijke live on the top floor. And what they would have been doing is, you know, chatting and getting together. Robert, you see throughout the novel, Robert doing a lot of little chores for Martin that Martin can't do for himself, like bringing out rubbish and stuff. But there's a real affection between all of these characters, and because the novel does start with Elsbeth's death, you don't necessarily get much of that backstory, but it's kind of felt as a foundation for the future relationships.
I want to ask you a question that's come in for us by email. It's very simple. Do you believe in ghosts? It's from Roddy.
I don't, actually. It's too bad. I think it's an extraordinarily elegant and beautiful idea. And in the course of working on the book, I've spoken to a lot of people who have told me about their own experiences. So it's not even people relating second or third hand. People say, this happened to me. And usually the experiences take the form of seeing someone who has died who's giving some sort of warning or advice, or just something as simple. My great aunt, after her husband died, she said that she would frequently be in bed and she would feel him sit down on the bed near her feet. But, you know, very, very simple things which to me sound wonderful and amazing. So I won't definitively say, oh, no, there's no such thing. But I have no personal experience that would tell me that it was so.
And yet you've created a character who is very believable.
Well, one of the things about fiction is that you can do anything. And the ghost is just as real as any of the other characters because they're all made up. And so in fiction, you know, you can have talking toasters, and that if you can invest them with enough character and humor and so forth, the toaster is a real entity in the mind of the reader.
The book, as we saw when you read that little excerpt, deals not only, of course, with Elsbeth of the ghost, but starts with her death. Is death and dying something that attracts you as an artistic device? Is it something that intellectually you're fascinated by?
As a visual artist, I've been coming around and around and back to it for a very long time. And I remember being berated when I was a graduate student by all my 50-something professors who were like just not interested in looking at all this memento mori that I was creating and thought I was being very perverse. But I find it interesting. I am interested in the things that we living people do to commemorate our dead and the ways that we react to death. And particularly in America, there seems to be a powerful cultural imperative to ignore death. So, you know, you might turn on the TV and see lots of things blowing up and lots of characters getting killed and so forth, but it always seems to come with this implication that it's something that happens to other people, not us.
Do you find the Highgate Cemetery and other cemeteries that you go to, and you call yourself a cemetery tourist, do you find them disturbing places? Do you find them serene?
Well, it depends on the individual cemetery. Many of them are absolutely beautiful. But, of course, it depends on how each community has decided to deal with it. Before Katrina, I was in New Orleans, and I went to a cemetery that was obviously for very poor people. And there were a lot of unmarked graves, or graves that were being marked with just two pieces of wood nailed together into a cross. And that cemetery was very prone to flooding, and it had all sorts of problems. And that cemetery made me sad. I mean, it was a testimonial to people's urge to commemorate, no matter what lack of resources they might have. But it also showed a lot about the inequality of the society.
Your book is inevitably going to be compared to The Time Traveler's Wife. It just is. Are there cemeteries?
Several people who worked with me on it, notably Joseph Riegel, my agent, commented that Her Fearful Symmetry takes a lot of the rules of Time Traveler and kind of turns them inside out. So one of the most interesting things about writing a novel is the decisions you make at the beginning of the project. And so whereas Time Traveler focused on two characters and was told in first person, this has a wide cast of characters and it's in close third. A lot of what is being thought about in this new one was brought up by the way that Time Traveler's Wife ends. And everybody out there in Radioland, if you want to read the book Time Traveler and you haven't, just plug your ears for a minute. So Time Traveler ends with someone losing their husband. And there's a jump in that book to a period far future of the wife's life. And so that interval of grieving is somewhat skipped over. And so in this book, I started by going back to this moment when Robert loses his lover and then proceed to get very detailed about how that would feel and what might happen. And although the characters are different, you know, we're not revisiting Henry and Claire, I'm working out some of the issues that I found myself left with after I finished my first book.
I'm Catty Kay. You are listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join Audrey and I, please do call 1-800-433-8850 or do send us an email to drshow@wmu.org. I'm going to go and open the phones now to Nancy in San Antonio, Texas. Nancy, you've joined the conversation to speak to Audrey.
Yes, good morning. I just wanted to say I turned on the program just at the beginning, just when you were commenting on when Elspeth dies, and that I haven't read your book, but that is the most incredible, beautiful scene, the way you just described it, what she spoke while he was out getting tea. And you read that, and then y'all went on to talk about something else, and I've just been left with that ever since. I just had to call and tell you that is the most beautiful scene, and I can't wait to read your book.
Nancy, thank you very much. A very nice compliment for you there.
Thank you. Yes, thank you very much.
Let's go to Heather in Boone, North Carolina. Heather, you've joined the program to speak to Audrey.
Yes, ma'am. First of all, let me say I'm a huge fan of the book. I actually just recently read it. The one thing I had a question about for Time Traveler's Wife while I was reading it was how complicated was it for you to create the outline that would show the continuity of the character development and to me, that must have been absolutely incredibly intense.
Well, one of the things that's lovely is that I spent 4.5 years writing the book, and it's much easier to make a puzzle than it is to solve one. So for me, it was sort of a long, patient business of keeping things untangled. I was working with two timelines, one for Claire and the other one for Henry and all his jumping around. But also that one kept track of what the reader knows at any given moment. And so I was very conscious of giving and withholding information both between the characters and between myself and the reader. But actually, it was a great pleasure. I love doing that kind of thing.
How different was it for you, Audrey, writing Time Traveler and Her Fearful Symmetry?
When I began to write Her Fearful Symmetry, I decided that I wanted to write something different. And I didn't want to just repeat myself and keep doing the same thing over and over. So for me, actually, the most complicated thing was something which I hope the reader will never notice, which is the way that point of view moves among all these different characters and how we can be intimately involved in each character's thoughts. And the next sentence, we're in somebody else's mind. And so I was looking at writers that do that brilliantly, such as Virginia Woolf, and trying to learn how to do it myself.
After the success of Time Traveler, which was huge, I think it sold 3 million copies.
I think we're close to 6 million worldwide.
I have undersold you.
Well, in America,
but
I think it's
done fabulously well. Did that put a certain pressure on you, writing this book? Did it change the way you approached the writing?
Well, in order to get anything done, you have to be very quiet and very private and forget that anybody is watching. And because I spent a lot of time running around touring for Time Traveler, it was difficult to get to that very quiet place. But eventually I thought, well, if I keep on talking about that first book all the time, I'll never really get with these new characters. And so I sort of cut off constantly chatting about the first book. And because I am 46 and because I have a long career as a visual artist, I actually had some practice at leaving behind a body of work and beginning the next body of work. And so I just did that.
Audrey Niffenegger, her new book is Her Fearful Symmetry. You can join our conversation. 1-800-433-8850 is the phone number. Do stay listening. We're going to take a short break.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Googled, the end of the world as we know it.
Google expanded its definition of search. It began as searching text. And then they said, well, why can't we expand search to books, television, and all these other businesses that they began to bump into?
That's media critic Ken Auletta. His new book is about the all-knowing, all-powerful, ever-expanding Google. Join us.
Welcome back. I'm Katty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. I'm joined in the studio by Audrey Niffenegger. Her new book is Her Fearful Symmetry. Audrey, while we were on a break, an email came in for us from Hope Vestergaard, who writes, how do you think your writing has developed or changed since you wrote Time Traveler's Wife?
I think that my writing is getting a lot tighter and more controlled. Time Traveler's Wife is full of exuberant digressions and all sorts of there's just all sorts of stuff packed into it. It's in some ways a typical first novel where you just put everything and the kitchen sink in there and let it rip. The new one is very pared down, and also because I was writing about a place, London, where I have never lived, it's full of the results of a lot of careful observation and eavesdropping and sort of thinking about what belonged in the novel and what didn't. So, yeah.
Did you go to Highgate and do research?
Yes, I started in 2003, and about a year later they asked me if I would like to be a tour guide. And so I've been a volunteer guide on whatever weekends I happen to be in London.
Is it bleaker, this book, than Time Traveler? Time Traveler is dark, but it's essentially romantic.
Time Traveler is very dark. It has this core of nihilism at the center, which I think many people either aren't interested in looking at or simply don't see. But the kind of exterior of the book is exuberant and very kind of kamikaze. And with the new one, I think it's necessarily somewhat bleaker because the overt subject is loss and grief. But there are also a lot of moments of humor, and all the different couples in the book have different endings. There's a little motto that I had for the thing, which is be careful what you wish for, and everyone gets what they deserve, like a true 19th century novel. And so various characters develop as the book goes on and eventually earn their endings.
Let's go back to the phones to Marla in Traverse City, Michigan. Marla, you've joined the program.
Thank you. I'm a bookseller in Traverse City, and every time someone asks for The Time Traveler's Wife, I have to tell them it's on my top 10 all-time list. I don't have my book in front of me, but I'm under the impression you have two characters in both books named Henry. Is there someone special named Henry in your life?
There's no Henry in the new book. Henry de Tamble in the first book is not named for anybody in particular. I just like the name.
But there are a lot of characters in the second book, but on my reading of it, there wasn't a Henry either.
No.
I thought you were just speaking about a Henry. I'm sorry.
Well, I was, but we were talking about the previous book. No, the men in the new book are Martin, Robert, Jack, James, and Sebastian.
Let's go to Judy in Washington, D.C. Judy, you have a question about the visual art side of Audrey's life and how it has influenced her work.
Yes, I found the comment very interesting. I'm a painter and am also kind of attracted to memento mori images. And you were talking about the story of the feeling of someone sitting on the edge of a bed, and it reminded me of the inspiration I had for a painting, which was to turn on the Today Show one morning and see an image of a dead soldier, a 17th century soldier that had just been unearthed in the permafrost. And it stayed in my head, and I decided I would do a painting of it. I went to an artist colony to do the painting, and there was a woman there who was writing a book called Life After Loss. And it turned out to be this interesting dialogue that I was having with a writer at the same time that I was working on a painting. And it seems to me that your writing is very much of an overlapping of those two things. And I just wanted to make that comment.
Certainly, it's incredibly fruitful to be able to do both the writing and the visual work. I'd like to spring off of your comment to recommend to artists and writers and creative people the artist colonies. I don't know which one you were at.
I'm afraid she's
gone. Oh, she's gone. Okay. But anyway, I've gone to several, and they're marvelous places to encounter people in other creative disciplines, and you can have these very fruitful conversations.
Audrey, we have an email here actually from another Audrey in Raleigh, North Carolina, touching on this subject, and she writes to us, "I have found that few visual artists can write successfully. Many times they are indulgent or the experiment simply doesn't work. Your first book, however, was enriched by your background. Could you address problems or advantages of being a visual artist who also writes?"
I have had the very interesting experience for about 10 years now of teaching visual artists writing. I work at Columbia College, and most of the students I've been working with are graduate students in a book arts program. Some of them are fantastic writers already, and some of them are just beginning to try. And most of the time what we're working on is trying to bring the writing and the imagery together. I think it's actually easier for visual artists to move into writing than it is for writers to become visual artists. Partially because as we come along in school, we've all had some training in reading books and writing and trying to write essays and so forth. But most of us get so little training in drawing and in visual thinking and in anything pertaining to the visual arts. So my experience is it's actually easier for artists to write than it is for writers to make art.
Audrey, how do you decide when you're thinking of a story or you're thinking of a theme, whether it's going to be a work of visual art or whether you're going to write about it? Why didn't you write Time Traveler, for example? Could that have been visually represented?
I initially when I first had the idea, which came in the form of the actual phrase, the time traveler's wife, I thought, oh, this will be one of those picture books that I've been making. And almost immediately realized that for someone who's hopping in and out of time, that words would be necessary, because still images have a very hard time dealing with time flow, whereas something like a film or a novel has a very easy time, relatively speaking. But words can do things that images can't, and vice versa. They are specific in different ways. An image has no dialogue. There's no way for it to represent dialogue other than in comics, the speech balloon. On the other hand, in writing, you can describe and describe, but the image in the reader's head will never be precisely what's in the writer's head, whereas if I made a picture of it, we would both be looking at the same thing.
Fascinating. Let's go to the phones again, to David in Grand Rapids, Michigan. David, you've joined the phone, I think, to speak to Audrey Knott for the first time.
Hi, Audrey. This is Dave, an old friend of yours from Evanston. And
oh, baby.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm excellent. I'm just so happy to hear about your success, and we have to have that cup of coffee soon. But anyway, building on the idea of imagery, I was wondering if you could share just maybe what has life experience been like for you living where you've lived, and in particular, I enjoy seeing you draw upon the names of buildings you used to pass by on the train, or experiences that you had in art school that maybe show up in your books, and how that's so important to see that those can be fruitful experiences that you just use in your creativity now.
Yeah, you're touching on something. The building that all the characters live in the new book is called Vautravers, and we did indeed ride past that day after day after day on the Red Line in Chicago. It's a little transplant. Yeah, it's amazing when you're creating a fictional world, so much of the real world gets in there. Some of it, I mean, you're so powerful when you're writing a novel, because you can resurrect the dead, you can take things that don't exist anymore, little bits of London that probably won't exist in a few years, and you can preserve things, and you can make two things that never came together suddenly converge. It's an amazing thing.
You mentioned earlier the character who is who partly inspired Martin in Fearful Symmetry, the friend of yours who has obsessive compulsive disorder. To what extent are your characters based on people you have known or do know?
In this new book, there are two that are directly inspired. One is Martin, and I should immediately say that Martin as a personality is quite different from my real, actual friend. It's not a portrait in quite that way, but in getting to know my friend and talking to him about living with OCD, a lot of what he said was extraordinarily insightful and led me to start thinking about what that would be like. In the case of the character Jessica in the new book, she is a portrait of...
We should say who Jessica is. We haven't introduced Jessica
indeed,
yet.
Indeed, that's right. Jessica is the chairman of the Friends of Highgate Cemetery in the novel, and she is modeled on Jean Pateman, who is the chairman of the Friends of Highgate Cemetery in real life until quite recently. And Jean Pateman is also the person to whom the book is dedicated, because without Jean, it just wouldn't have happened. It would have been some other book entirely. Jean tutored me on the cemetery, and after I had been coming around for a while, I asked her if I could model a character on her, because I couldn't imagine the place without her. And she didn't even pause. She said, okay. And I thought, wow, that's amazing trust there. And because she was so lovely and trusting, it put a burden of responsibility and good behavior on me.
And I have to say, Jessica comes out very well in the book.
Jessica's delightful, both in fiction and in real life.
So Jean should be happy.
Jean is happy, and it's a source of great pleasure to me that Jean enjoys the book.
Let's go back to the phones, to Richard, who has joined the program from Grand Rapids. Richard, you're on the air.
Hello, ladies.
Good morning.
Hello.
I was just wondering about... I First of all, I'm halfway through the book, where Robert just kissed Valentina for the first time.
Now, we have to be careful, Richard, because we don't want any spoilers on the program.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Keep on.
Okay. Anyway, I was just wondering about the symbolism of the white kitty of death.
Well, harking back to Wilkie Collins' The Woman in White, there's a lot of color symbolism in that book, and there's one character, Anne, who always wears white and gets very distraught if she has to wear any other color. The twins, the younger set of twins, Julie and Valentina, you often will see them. There's one pivotal scene in the book where they're both wearing white strictly to identify them with these other characters. And the symbolism of the little kitten of death, who's also white, it's to give a sense that the kitten might be sort of otherworldly, though she's not, to identify her with some of the attributes of the color white, such as purity. And also just to create a visual. I'm often thinking about what things will look like, and even though it's all abstract, it's all words on the page, I want certain things to happen in your head while you're reading, and so there's something about this almost spectral kitten who makes her appearance in this moonlit night on a high wall that I just like how that looks.
I'm Cathy Kay, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join us, please do call 1-800-433-8850 or do send an email with your questions and comments for Audrey Niffenegger to drshow@wamu.org. And let's go to Tony in West Lafayette, Indiana. Tony, thank you very much for your patience. I know you've been waiting a long time, and also for helping us out with that line of poetry.
Okay. Yes, the William Blake sonnet that she had referenced was "Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forest of the night. What immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry?"
Thank you.
Thank you, Tony.
Yeah. All right, thank you.
And let's go to Julia in St. Louis, Missouri. Julia. And Julia, you have read the book and you love the ending of it, but we don't want you to give it away, okay?
Right. No, I won't. I do so love the ending. It's so different than what I was expecting. I have a couple of questions. One, were you involved with, or have you seen, and or what do you think of the movie, The Time Traveler's Wife? And we waited so long for this second book. Is there a third one on the way?
Well, as far as the movie goes, Hollywood people really don't want novelist people hanging around looking over their shoulders. And when I first sold the rights, which was before Time Traveler's Wife was published, everyone who knew anything about it said, "Okay, now let go." And I said, "Oh no, I'm going to be helpful. I'm going to help." And everybody said, "No, no, no, just let go." So after a few false starts of trying to be helpful and being firmly but politely discouraged, I said, "Okay, I understand now." The film people had to make a film, which is a very challenging thing when you have a gigantic novel full of all sorts of subplots, and there's no way it's going to all get in there. And so they had to make some decisions. When you write, you're making a set of instructions for people to make the movie in their heads. And everybody then proceeds to make their own movie, and everybody in your head looks exactly the way you want them to look, and it all is very personalized for you. But when you go watch the film, the people who make the film have to get it down to one definitive vision, and it's highly unlikely that that vision will be the novelist's vision, or probably that of many of the people who go see the film. Sometimes the filmmaker is very audacious and can overcome this, like, say, if you're Stanley Kubrick, for example. Sometimes they try to be very faithful, like the people who make the Harry Potter movies, and sometimes they just kind of plot their own course, and my understanding is that that's what happened with my movie, though I have not seen the movie of Time Traveler's Wife, which was part of the letting go.
Will there be a movie of her fearful symmetry?
So far, I have held on to the film rights. One of the difficulties is that I can't imagine some other cemetery playing Highgate Cemetery, so we have to talk to the Highgate Cemetery friends and see what they think.
We have a few seconds before we go. A third book. How much longer do we have to wait?
Well, the third book, I believe, is going to be set in a suburb of Chicago, so it eliminates the research hurdle.
Audrey Niffenegger is the author, of course, of Time Traveler's Wife. Her new book is Her Fearful Symmetry. Audrey, thank you for joining me in the studio.
Thank you so much.
Thank you all so much for listening. I'm Cathy Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.